We're going to get started. We do have rather a lot to work through. I'm completely amazed that there are people here who've been to my philosophy for 45 minutes and have chosen formal logic as the first. Good for you. I shall do my very, very best. In the first session, I'm going to be going over a lot of the things that I covered in the podcasts on critical reasoning. Can I get a feel for how many people have seen those podcasts?
Put your hand up if you...
Okay, and not you, but you have. Okay, so that will give you a good grounding, and you will always be able to go away and look at them, if there's anything. So in the first session, we're really going to gallop through quite a few things that if you'd like more of, you can get it on the podcasts. And then I'm going to slow down a bit, because we then get to the difficult stuff. This is dead easy, of course, you know that. Okay, now I assume that you're all here because you'd quite like to be able to read leaders in the Times or something like that, and immediately see whether they're good arguments or bad arguments or something like that. Have a look at those two arguments and see what you think. No, that's why I said your apologies. No, I didn't make up that I made the arguments a bit easier than they actually were. Right. But you'll see that argument says that life's not going to be worth living in the future, and that argument says life's going to get better in the future. Well, clearly they can't both be right. Wouldn't it be nice to look at each argument and find out, just by looking at them, which is the right one? Well, I don't promise that you'll be able to do that by the end of this weekend, but you'll certainly have the right tools by which to go about it. So in the first lecture we're going to be looking rather quickly at what arguments are, how to analyse them, and we'll look at the different types of argument, the fact that all arguments are either inductive or deductive, and that any other type of argument falls into one or other of those two categories. So let's start by looking at what arguments are. So here's a definition, and this is from a book written by a really wonderful woman. Can't recommend it highly enough. Sadly, it's not yet ready. I was hoping it would be ready for this weekend, but it's not. But and because it's my first e-book, I can't even give you a publisher and say it'll be available on any device like Kindle or iPad and so on. But I'll be so you need to follow me on Twitter and find out when it's coming out, or on my website. So, an argument is a set of sentences in which one sentence is being asserted on the basis of the others. And you see I've put the S in brackets because there might only be one other sentence. So there are two sorts of sentences in an argument. The sentence that's being asserted, and that's called the conclusion of the argument, and the sentences on the basis of which that one is being asserted, and those are called the premises, and there need to be more than one premise. So the premises are offered as reasons for believing the conclusion. So that's the... And it's particularly important to note that an argument is firstly a set of sentences, and secondly, that it's a set of sentences that are related in a very particular way. So, have a look at this. I couldn't get the pagination right, but have a look at that and tell me why that's not an argument.
It's certainly, it just states quite correctly, to our knowledge, nothing travels faster than light in a vacuum, but it just goes on and on and on, and then says exactly the same thing as it did at the beginning.
Jim, I mean, Lynn is arguing, I mean, she's trying to put forward reasons for what she's claiming, but Jim is just stating the same thing over and over, and I mean, you end up wanting to hit him about two sentences into the argument, I think. Nothing travels faster than light in a vacuum. Nothing travels faster than light in a vacuum. Nothing travels faster than light in a vacuum. That's not an argument, is it? It may be a conclusion, but he's not giving any reasons for his conclusion. Therefore, it isn't an argument. So a single sentence like that can't be an argument. Actually, I'm going to immediately change that, because single sentences can be arguments. Have a look at this sentence. Trees only shed leaves if it's autumn or if they're sick, and it's obvious they aren't ill, so it must be autumn. It's only if a single sentence is a complex sentence that can be analysed as a set of sentences, and the set of sentences must be related in the right way, that we've got an argument. That is an argument in a single sentence. And just to say that a complex sentence is constituted of other sentences. So a simple sentence like Marianne is wearing red is a simple sentence because all its parts, Marianne is wearing red, are substantial. There isn't a part of that sentence that is itself a sentence. Okay, a set of sentences can only be an argument if the sentences and sets are related as follows. As of the definition, one of the sets, the conclusion, must be being asserted, the others must be being offered as reasons for believing that conclusion. If there isn't that relation between the set of sentences, then the set of sentences is a set of sentences, it's not an argument. So let's have a look at these. If it's Friday, the library is open. Is that an argument? Why not? You're right, it's not. Why isn't it? It is a statement. That's right. It's only one sentence, actually, isn't it? It's a conditional. Lots of people confuse conditionals with arguments, though, because of the implication, if it's Friday, the library will be open. And people think of if-then statements as arguments, but that's not the case. You have to have an entailment, a relation of premises and conclusion between the sentences of an argument. What about the second one? It's not possible to make a good cup of tea without boiling the water. You didn't boil the water. The cup of tea you made is undrinkable. Is that an argument? Yes. Hold up your hand if you think it is. Okay, hold up your hand if you think it isn't. Okay, those who think it isn't, why isn't it? John? Steve?
The conclusion is it's related to the premises.
Which is the conclusion, do you think?
Conclusion is the first statement.
No, that's not the conclusion. The conclusion is the argument for the sentence for which we're arguing, the sentence that is being asserted. The cup of tea you made is undrinkable. Actually, this is a bit of a strange one because it could either the cup of tea you made is undrinkable or it could be you didn't boil the water, couldn't it? Do you see that? So it's, the argument could be it's not possible to make a good cup of tea without boiling the water. You didn't boil the water, therefore the cup of tea you made is undrinkable. Or it could be it's not possible to make a good cup of tea without boiling the water. The cup of tea you made is undrinkable. Therefore, you didn't boil the water. It's not necessarily a good argument, but it's still an argument. Don't forget, at the moment, all we're doing is trying to identify an argument. We're not trying to evaluate the argument as well.
In fact, Marianne, would this be correct? I put up, I had saying it was an argument, but in fact, if you work on that basis, then you're saying that a good cup of tea is the same as it is drinkable. And they needn't be the same.
You're absolutely right. There's an implication there that good and undrinkable, or good is the opposite of undrinkable, and we'll be looking at that later on. So you're quite right on that. No, this is in fact an argument, and it's not clear what the conclusion is. It might be either of those two sentences, but there are three sentences here, and they are, or at least could be, related in such a way that one is being asserted and the others are being offered as reasons for believing it. What about number three? Put your hands up if you think that one's an argument. Don't worry if you're getting things wrong, by the way. Everyone gets things wrong to start off with.
It's very bad. When the bulbs flow...
Remember, we're not wondering if an argument is good or bad. We're just asking whether it's an argument.
No, but you're saying the red one didn't go with the others. If you take that literally, a flower can't get up and walk. So it can't be.
But you needn't take it literally.
It's non-sequitur, so it can't be an argument.
A non-sequitur is actually a bad argument. Yes. So a non-sequitur is an argument, isn't it?
Okay.
Okay, who thinks that's not an argument? Yep. Good, you're right. Okay, we've got there just two sentences. They may be related, but they're not related as premises and conclusion. And what about retrievers are friendly dogs? Amber is a retriever, so Amber is a friendly dog. Do you think that's an argument?
Yes.
Yeah, Emma's nodding there, quite rightly so. And incidentally, I've got a list of all the exercises have got answers. And there's an answer book here. And now I think I could hand them out now, or I could keep them and you can check them later, because you've got all the slides, so you might want to go over the exercises again later and you'll have the arguments. No, the handouts is a different thing, and I'll explain the handouts as I go along you'll see when I need to. So you'll see that at the bottom of the slide it says answers in your answer book, page 2. And when you get one of the answer books, you'll see what I mean. Does anyone not have... The handouts are at the back, by the way. All the slides are in the handouts at the back. Okay. Any questions at the moment about how to recognise arguments? So I said we're going to do three things today, and that's the first thing that we're doing. We've looked at what an argument is. So any questions about that, or is that straightforward? Good. Okay. We're now going to look at how to analyse arguments, and two things about that have already come up, so that's good. To analyse an argument, we set it out the logic book style. Okay, so we're taking the last one of the previous exercise. The first premise is retrievers are friendly dogs. Second premise is Amber is a retriever. The conclusion is Amber is a friendly dog. So those premises are reasons for believing that conclusion. But you can see that when you set it out like that, it makes it much easier to understand which sentence is the conclusion and which sentences are the premises. It's much easier to see which sentences are playing the role. It's also easier to...
Yes, of course. Previous slide. Amber is a friendly dog. Retrievers are friendly dogs. Therefore, Amber is a retriever.
That would be another argument.
Okay.
Yeah. It would be a different argument from this one, but it would be another argument. Yeah. Okay, so analysing an argument makes it much easier, as you'll see later, to identify what sort of argument it is, as well as to identify the argument itself. It reveals the logical structure of the argument, and again, I'll explain what I mean by that later on. But you can see how the conclusion follows from the premises much more easily when it's set out logic book style. And it's much easier to evaluate. I mean, for example, if we go back to the ones with which we started. Now, can you imagine that if those were set out as premise, conclusion, it would be much easier to see what the argument is than it is when you look at it like that. When it's just, you're hit by all these words and all these sentences and you're not quite sure, you have to work out which one is a premise, which one is a conclusion. By the time you've analysed those, which is something you're going to do later tonight maybe, on your own, you'll see what the argument is. Okay, so here are the steps to analysing an argument, and we're going to go through each of these steps. And I've put this in the handout for you as well. It's in page 2, because as we go through, I'll ask you occasionally what the next step might be, and you can refer to your handout and tell me. Okay, so first, we identify the conclusion of the argument. Anyone tell me why the conclusion of the argument is what we identify first? Anyone can tell me why that's the case?
There's no argument there. We must have a conclusion. There's no argument.
Without a conclusion, well, without premises, there isn't an argument either. But it's true. The premises are premises for that conclusion. And so the conclusion actually is really the fulcrum on which the argument turns. If you can identify the conclusion, it gives you a way into the rest of the argument, if you like. Second thing we do is identify the premises of the argument. That's what gives us the logic book style, or at least the form of the logic book style, because we know which sentence is the conclusion, which sentences are the premises. The third thing we do is we remove ambiguities and cross-references. And I put in brackets if there are any, because of course sometimes there aren't, and that's fine. But you should always check an argument to see if there's any ambiguity in this, or if there's any cross-reference. And I'll explain, again, I'll go through each of the steps, so if there's anything you don't understand about these, I hope it'll be explained later. The fourth step is to eliminate irrelevancies. Again, if there are any, but there are often irrelevancies in an argument, because when we argue with each other, we tend to do much more than argument. We tend to give an idea of what we feel about the argument, for example, or whether we accept the argument. So sometimes we have to remove those irrelevancies in order to see what the argument itself is. Okay. And the fifth step, is it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is to remove inconsistent terminology. Now, you, Alan, you pointed that out in the argument about, because the word good and the word undrinkable, so the word undrinkable there was being used to mean not good, wasn't it? Mm. We wouldn't have lost anything in the argument if we had changed undrinkable for not good, or if we changed good for drinkable. Do you see what I mean? It makes the argument much more obvious as we're doing it, if we can get rid of distracting things like inconsistent terminology. And finally, we want to explicate any suppressed premise. If there is a suppressed premise, then we want to bring it out and put it into the argument, because the argument won't be a good one if actually you've left out a premise. It might be good if you put that premise in, but without that premise it's not good, so we need to put the premise in. Okay, so let's analyse the argument above. So if you remember, I said there's a complex sentence. It is an argument, but we have to analyse it first. So the first thing we do is identify the conclusion. So what's the conclusion to that argument? Put your hand up, if you put your hands up when you think you know, and then... and there's a critical mass of. Okay, Sean, is it?
It must be autumn.
It must be autumn. Does everyone agree?
Yeah.
Okay, I think it's clear that that's the answer there. So, it must be autumn is the conclusion. And notice that I've taken out the word, I mean, the sentence was actually so it must be autumn. But we don't need the so. Because it only indicated the conclusion, didn't it? And we've now got conclusion. We've got a label conclusion on it, so we don't need the so. One of the ways in which you find a conclusion is that it may be indicated by a conclusion word. So is obviously such a word. Can anyone think of any others?
Therefore,
ergo.
Thus.
Yep, all these are very good conclusion words. They give you an immediate indication that here is the conclusion about to come. Any others?
Hence?
Yes, hence is a conclusion word. Okay, now I don't know if I'm going to say this.
Do you need the must?
Sorry?
Do you need the must?
The must is probably itself a bit of a giveaway as well.
It is autumn, you can say.
Yes. A must could be, it could be part of a premise as well. So a good cup of tea must be made with boiling water, for example. The must there would have not been a conclusion indicator. So you've got to be careful, more careful with must than with so, hence, thus, therefore, etc.
Do you read the cons also on?
Well, because can work both ways, actually. So I can say the trees, it must be autumn because...
But is that because indicates the conclusion, albeit probably...
Well, it's indicating the premises there, isn't it? I mean, I suppose in virtue of indicating the premises, it is indicating the conclusion as well. But I tend to think of because as a premise indicator rather than a conclusion. And I take your point. I mean, immediately you know because can... Not always, actually. There's a one later little... that I think will be a counterexample to that. Okay, a couple of things. Conclusions are not always at the end of the argument. I could have said it must be autumn because trees only shed their leaves if they're sick or if it's autumn and they're obviously not ill. Do you see what I mean? I could have put the conclusion. Or the conclusion could have been in the middle. So a conclusion could be anywhere. You can't tell that a sentence is a conclusion because it's at the end of an argument. Nor can you always, there are not always conclusion indicators in an argument. So you might see so or therefore or thence, etc., but you might not. So I could have said trees only shed their leaves if they're sick, or it's autumn, and they're obviously not ill, it must be autumn. Just left out the so. It'd still be an argument, wouldn't it? And the only foolproof way to identify a conclusion is by the role it's playing in the argument. What is the role played by a conclusion? What is the role played by a conclusion in an argument?
What's being asserted?
It's the sentence that's being asserted, that's right. The others are being offered as reasons for that conclusion. Once you put it out logic book style, it terminates the argument. But I think it would be a mistake to think of a conclusion as terminating an argument when you're thinking about how to identify a conclusion, because the conclusion doesn't always terminate an argument.
Not in the way it's written on the page. Yeah.
No, but it's only if you've set it out logic book style that the conclusion will certainly terminate the argument. And one way in which you can say, sometimes it's very difficult to tell whether something which is the conclusion or not, and it can help to read the argument out loud, to actually, with feeling, once more with feeling, because by putting the feeling, by actually acting it out, the sound of the words will indicate the conclusion to you quite often as you do it. And of course, actually, you would then discover the ambiguity of that one that we saw earlier, the tea's undrinkable, because actually you could do it in two ways. Okay, so the second thing we've got to do is identify the premises. We've got the conclusion, it must be autumn. What are the premises in this argument? Put your hands up when you've got them. Okay, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name already.
Mary.
Good, okay. I think it's probably good to put the or together. So you've got trees only shed leaves if it's autumn or they're sick. And the second premise is it's obvious they aren't ill. The and drops out again, because like the so, it's no longer needed. You could leave it in and say this is a one-premise argument, but it's actually... if it looks more like an argument to take the and out. So premise one, trees only shed leaves if it's autumn or they're sick. Premise two, it's obvious they aren't ill. Conclusion, it must be autumn. Okay, is that straightforward?
Why is premise two not a conclusion? It doesn't sound, the premises normally seem to be based on some sort of fact or something. It's obvious they aren't ill. It doesn't really seem to have any fact of any kind in it.
One of the things that you often find in an argument is that people will argue for one of the premises at the same time as they argue for the conclusion. But that's not necessarily the case. When people do that, you actually need to get rid of the argument for the premise when you're setting out the argument itself. And here, okay, you're not given a reason to believe this, but that's the dead giveaway that it's not the conclusion. That is being used as a conclusion, as a premise for this.
So a premise can be an unfactually based judgment.
A premise can be any declarative sentence, any sentence that's either true or false. You don't have to back it up in any way. So I can say, oh God, I can't think of an example. give me an unfactually based statement and I'll give you an argument. Or give me an example. What?
Jabberwocky is a creature.
A Jabberwocky is a creature. All creatures have four legs, therefore a Jabberwocky has four legs. Okay, it's not a very good argument. It's certainly the case that the premises aren't true, but it's an argument, isn't it?
So premises don't need to be true.
A premises certainly don't need to be true. We'll have a look at that later as well, as you in quite some depth, I think.
I very much want to...
I just want to say, we're not looking at how to evaluate arguments at the moment. very important. All we're looking at the moment is how to identify an argument. The thing about arguments is they can be good or bad. And one reason we want to be able to identify them is we want to be able to evaluate them as good or bad. But if you can only evaluate good arguments, if you can only determine good arguments, then you're going to miss all the bad arguments. That wouldn't be a good idea.
I very much want to break premise one into two premises.
And how would you do that?
Trees only shed their leaves if it's autumn. Trees only shed their leaves if they're sick. I suppose I'd have to eliminate only in that case, wouldn't I? Because only applies to...
Only applies to both. Exactly. Do you see, you quite rightly answer your own question here. You actually can't make that into two sentences. Mary, you were wondering if you... Yes, you were wondering too. If that were an and... That would be different. The only would still get in the way a bit there.
Well, the problem is, don't we? Because we have exclusive laws and not exclusive laws.
And we'll look at that later on. You're quite right.
If the only wasn't there, I think I'd still be tempted to split it.
If it's an and, it's almost certainly the case you can split it. If it's an or, my advice would be don't split it.
Fine.
And P and Q. Well, P, Q, you don't really need the and as long as you're asserting P and you're asserting Q.
Yes.
But P or Q...
is a different case, yeah.
One of them or the other one might not be true, might it? So you can't just assume both of them are there. Okay, so we've got our premises and we've got our conclusions. So if that were all black, it would be set out argument book style, logic book style. Okay, so our next task is to remove the ambiguities and cross-references. We remove ambiguities because they threaten clarity. And we're not going to, in the book I go into ambiguity in some detail because there are lots of different types of ambiguity. So if I say, we're going to do some exercises. A word is ambiguous if it has two meanings, or two or more meanings, I should say. Or a sentence can be structurally ambiguous. In other words, the words could be ordered in different ways. So, the black taxi drivers are on strike. Is it the taxi drivers that are black that are on strike, or is it the drivers of black taxis that are on strike, etc. I said we were going to do this at home, but I wonder if we've got time to do it now. Let's do a couple of them. Every good girl loves a sailor. Okay, how is that ambiguous? Can you come up with two different ways of saying it?
That sailor's going to be really snowed under.
So you're assuming there is a sailor such that every girl loves him.
Yes.
There is a sailor such that every girl loves him. Okay, just one sailor. But of course it needn't mean that.
Every girl loves him.
Every girl is such that there is a sailor whom she loves. Are you with me?
Yes.
Okay, so you need quantifiers to disambiguate that. It's where the there is goes. Is it that there is a sailor such that everybody loves him, every girl loves him? Or is it that every girl is such that there is a sailor such that she loves him? Which means there are many different sailors, one for each girl. Okay, I'm going to let you do that at home. If we have time at the end of this session, we'll come back to it. But I've given you the answers, so you can check those out for yourself later on. Okay, cross-references. Now, a cross-reference, or an anaphoric reference, can you see a cross-reference here? Something that is actually, once you separate the sentences, as we're doing in putting something together logic book style, it would be easy to lose the meaning if we don't remove the cross-reference. Can you see the cross-reference?
They, premise two.
Well done, yeah. What do we mean by they?
Trees.
The trees, exactly. So the they is actually referring to the trees. Trees don't shed leaves if it is autumn or if the trees, so actually they're two. So they, twice over, need to be changed for the trees. It's obvious the trees aren't ill, it must be autumn. So do you see again? When you're actually looking at whether the premise is true, we're using a very simple example here for obvious reasons, but if it were a really complicated argument, and you'll need to looking at each premise to see whether it's true, and you've separated the premise from everything else, it can be quite easy to lose track of what's intended by it, or he, or she, or whatever. So remove that cross-reference so you never lose track of what the it, or what the they, or what the she, or whoever mean. Now we ought to eliminate any irrelevancies.
Would it not make
sense?
Was
it about the previous slide?
Yeah, would it not make sense to remove the cross-references before you tease out the premises? If you went through the text and stripped out all of the sort of impersonal bits and gave them back their nouns,
you could do that.
You wouldn't. You'd remove the danger of losing track of.
You shouldn't be able to lose track of it by this stage either. It's as you get further on that you lose track. But yes, you could do it beforehand. Yep. I've never done it like that. But thinking about it, I can't see any reason at all why not.
Are these 6 points you put here?
Yeah.
Do they have to be done actually in this order? Whatever order you think.
No, I think you could. I know this order works.
Yes.
I'm inclined to say do it in that order. I'm sure you could do it in different orders, but I think as you're learning. I think it's a good idea to start with an order that we know to work.
Question, actually, back to John's point. It seems like it would be easier to remove the cross-references at the beginning if the pronoun, there are pronouns that are involved. If they're not pronouns, then it would be much harder. It seems like you'd have to analyze the premises. Get into it before you can figure out.
I'm sure that you're right. I can't think offhand of an example where that would be difficult, but yes, I don't know. I wouldn't like to say. I think you would be all right to remove the cross-references earlier. Okay, so we've got to remove the irrelevancies, if there are any. Have a look at that, see if there's anything you think it's irrelevant. If there is, put your hands up. Don't yell out at the moment, but give other people a chance to find out themselves. Okay, Sam.
Obvious.
It's obvious. Yes. I mean, there's no use for that, is there? It's just a little. Who cares whether it's obvious? What's important is whether it's true. Okay. Is there anything else? I don't think there is actually. No. You're going to say
all definite and all indefinite articles.
There aren't any ands, are there?
Oh, no.
Or indefinite articles. I mean, I wouldn't want to remove the definite articles because the grammar goes that, and you want to say, or trees are sick?
Yes.
Trees only shed leaves if it is autumn, or trees are sick. I think the trees makes it clear that. Yes, I prefer leaving the trees in there.
Could you remove leaves? They can't shed anything else.
I think you probably can actually, can't you? You can get rid of leaves there because there isn't anything else that trees can shed. Yeah. Yes, there it is. Yes, okay. Take it back. But I like that. Yes. If it were true that they could only shed leaves, then yes, you could get rid of that.
Can you spell it? Must be. It is.
Well, no, because is and must be are two very different statements, aren't they? And if something is the case, then it could be contingently true that it is the case. If it must be the case, then you're claiming it's necessarily true, either empirically or logically. So I think must stays. Okay.
Did you not say deciduous? I think that's the word, I'm not sure.
I'm not going to say deciduous, no, because I don't need to, for the sake of this argument, I don't think. The trees are deciduous when they shed their leaves, aren't they?
Yes, that's right.
So otherwise they'd be evergreens. Okay, I've just given away the answer to this question, annoyingly. Okay, are there any irrelevancies? Sorry, we've done that. Okay. Now we've got to remove inconsistent terminology, if there is any. Can you see any inconsistent terminology?
I don't think it's inconsistent, but I'm wondering if you want this to be a tight example, why you fluctuate between secondary, or why could you stick...
That's what I mean by inconsistent terminology. That's exactly right. So the original example I used was undrinkable and bad. While using sick and ill, completely unnecessary. And actually it didn't sound right, did it, when you read it? But that's because I went through and changed the word in order to have an equivalent inconsistent terminology. Okay, so inconsistent terminology arises when two different words mean roughly the same thing. Get rid of that sort of inconsistency, because all it does is distract us. So I know your English teacher told you to try and vary your language as much as possible because it makes it more interesting. We're not concerned about things being interesting here. All we want to know is whether they are logically correct. Okay, so we can get rid of sick and put... we can get rid of ill and put sick, or we could have done it the other way around. We could have put ill for both. Well done. Okay, so finally we need to add any suppressed premise. Many arguments, in fact most arguments in everyday life, are enthymemes. They're incomplete without the addition of an extra premise. And a suppressed premise is often a belief so common that we needn't make it explicit. So I say, oh, it's raining, do take your umbrella. Okay, so I'm not going to eke that out with, because if you take your umbrella, you won't get wet, or I'm assuming that you'll know exactly why I'm suggesting that you take your umbrella. So we often leave a premise out in an argument, but sometimes the premises we leave out are actually controversial. And to leave out a controversial premise is not acceptable. And to leave out a premise because we can assume that everybody believes it, is one thing. But to leave out a premise when actually it's because you don't want to draw attention to the fact that this premise is controversial is another thing entirely. Looking at the argument we're analysing, never mind whether it's controversial or not, is there a suppressed premise here?
Yes.
Okay, put your hand up if you think. Okay, Bill.
The trees are shedding their leaves.
Yes, because if the trees weren't shedding their leaves, we wouldn't have an argument, would we? So there's a suppressed premise there, but that's not a controversial one, is it? Or at least, probably not, it's not. Okay. So the premise we're adding is uncontroversial. It need only be if we're formalising the argument, if we're setting it out logic book style, we need to add in that suppressed premise. Because otherwise the argument won't be a valid one, if it is valid. In an informal version of the argument, people are just going to add it for themselves. Most of you didn't even notice there was a suppressed premise in that. And that's because you had already added it for yourself. But without it, the argument is an enthymeme.
Is that a way of looking to find an assumption, an underlying assumption?
There was an underlying assumption in that argument that we've made explicit by putting it in there. Yeah. Okay. Now, I thought we had some exercises on suppressed premises. There is one in the book. Maybe there isn't one here. Okay. So here's the unanalysed argument. And there's the analysed argument. And I think you'll agree that the logical structure of this, the structure of this argument is much more visible to you than it is here. And you can imagine if that were a much more complicated argument. I mean, that's a very simple argument. Nobody's really going to need to put that out logical style. But if that were a more complicated argument, doing this to it would make it much, much easier to evaluate, much, much easier to understand. Here we are. Let's just do a couple. Let's do that one. Women of childbearing age sometimes get pregnant. Women of childbearing age can't, therefore, be relied upon. What's the suppressed feeling there? Being pregnant makes you unreliable, or something to that effect. Yes, exactly. It's dangerous to text whilst driving. It should be made illegal. What's the suppressed premise there?
Dangerous things should be made illegal.
And you can see that that's actually controversial, isn't it? Do we want to make all dangerous things illegal? I mean, there are some dangerous things perhaps we want to make illegal, but there are other dangerous things like bungee jumping and so on that people,
for some reason, they volunteered to do it. Volunteers in the area. They volunteered to take on these injuries in their game or in their jumping big pools.
They have indeed. Yep. Yeah, but do we want to stop them being able to make that choice? Probably not in a free country, I think.
But is the suppressed premise not rather you shouldn't do dangerous things while driving? You shouldn't do dangerous things while driving.
Well, you could say we could make it stronger by saying one shouldn't do dangerous things whilst driving, things that are dangerous while driving should be banned, or something like that. Perhaps that would strengthen the argument. Yes, perhaps that, then it becomes quite a strong argument, doesn't it? Although, I was listening to something from the States last night, they're really angry about being made to wear seatbelts because it interferes with. You're not actually driving, anyways.
Do you really suppress premises? Because in a way, you're assuming definitions of words and context.
One of the things that beginners nearly always do is try and add everything into the argument. And you'll find that actually as you gain an experience, you'll start to see what can be left out. But it's a very common thing to start adding in everything. All you need is the premise that's going to make the conclusion followed from the premises.
So by suppressed premises you mean facts specifically to related to what you're
saying? Not facts necessarily, they may not be facts.
Things then?
Beliefs or sentences.
But other things that set a context that aren't related to it, but help you understand it, because they're not part of that argument, would not be classified as a suppressed premise.
Exactly so. Yep. I can feel that what you're doing is again something very common in a beginner, and there'll be other people in this room who are doing it, which is that you're trying to make an argument watertight before it can be an argument.
It makes it useful.
Sorry. No arguments can be useful even if they're not watertight. I mean, that would be an argument that would be useful to some people.
Doesn't it just piss off?
That argument has been used very often in the past, hasn't it? It's neither good nor is it complete.
It's a silly question in this context. I mean, it would be daft to argue, what do you mean by texting? What do you mean by driving? Mm-hmm. But I can see in some complicated arguments, you might want to ask, what do you mean by this term you've used? What is its definition?
You do, but that's not the job of the argument. I mean, the job of when you come to evaluating the argument, you may have to go to your dictionary and look up a word or something like that.
So
it's not the job of the argument to make clear the meaning of every word, if you like. I mean, we can assume that educated people will go to the dictionary.
Well, in this case, it is a silly argument.
Well, yeah, but silly question. No, but then,
of course, even then, if you use the word illegal, if you're going to vest it in the law, either to a bill of parliament, you have to be incredibly precise, and you cannot leave holes in your argument.
I am not for one minute saying that definitions aren't important. And the reason philosophers think definitions are important is if you utter a sentence with expressing a belief of yours, if I don't understand the sentence, I can't get to your belief. And if I don't understand your sentence, I can't determine whether it's true or false, can I? So I can't evaluate anything as true or false if I can't understand it. So I'm not for one minute denying the importance of interpretation, but I am saying that it's not necessarily the job of an argument to interpret every one of its terms. And if you are arguing, obviously it's sensible to try and use terms that more people will understand rather than fewer people.
Just because something's repugnant doesn't make it a bad argument. The argument is very good.
That's true.
The first thing, depending on your point of view, is a perfectly good argument.
Oh, I see. Well, you're saying, yes. Once you put the suppressed premise in there, it is actually a good argument.
Yes. That's the fact that you may or may
not. In one sense, and a sense that we'll be looking at later, but not now. Let's move on. Okay, so exercises again to do at home, and the answers are in your, or my answer is in your answer book. Those are the two ones with which we started. Okay, so that was, we've looked at what an argument is and how we analyse an argument, and the next thing we're going to look at is how to distinguish types of arguments. But are there any questions about analysing arguments that we haven't looked at?
The question about the suppressed premises, because it seems like there could be, maybe this goes back to what you said a few moments ago, there could be almost endless suppressed premises. Like in the first one, you had women of childbearing age, the suppressed premises that women can bear children. So,
well, hang on. Okay, so why is that a suppressed premise?
Let's see what I mean by it's got.
I see. That doesn't have any bearing on whether it's true or not, or whether it's or it supports.
It's an amplification of what one of the premises means, but a premise is a reason for believing a conclusion. If it's not a reason for believing a conclusion, it isn't a suppressed premise. Even if it is a reason for believing one of the premises, or all sorts of other things, or an amplification of the premise.
But doesn't that cry out for some? Some women of childbearing age get pregnant. That's true. You can't say all. Not all women are going to get pregnant.
That's true.
You can say some.
And even those who are going to get pregnant are not always pregnant. That's why the sometimes is in there.
Oh, that's allowed. You can put it's there. I thought that could be thrown out, an adjective and things like that. Adjectives and. It's an adverb.
Sorry. You probably could throw that out of that argument, but. Let's see. Okay, the conclusion is women of childbearing age can't be relied upon. Premise one is women of childbearing age get pregnant. Okay, so we can leave out sometimes if you like. And premise two, what was the suppressed one, as we said?
Pregnant
people or women?
Women.
I mean, if men got pregnant, maybe they would be reliable.
Maybe motherhood should be taken seriously by all.
Maybe, but that's not what this argument is. Okay, so the women of childbearing age get pregnant. Pregnant women are unreliable. Women of childbearing age can't be relied upon. Actually, at that point, it becomes a bit of a nonsense. It's a bit obvious, isn't it? But I don't think there's anything wrong with that argument. It's a good argument. But its premises might be questioned. Which means that you can question the conclusion. But again, I stress that we are not, at this moment, evaluating arguments. All we're doing is learning how to recognise them. Okay. So whether an argument is good or not is something we'll look at later on.
By argument, then you mean the connection between the premise and conclusion. To get to the premise in the first place is not part of the argument.
No. The definition of argument with which we started is an argument is a... What is an argument? Somebody tell me. What is an argument?
You have two sentences in which one sentence is being asserted on the basis of others.
There you are. An argument is a set of sentences in which one sentence is being asserted on the basis of the others.
The link between the conclusion and the premises, but not any of that stuff about how you got to the premise in the first place.
That's right. I mean, there would be another argument for the premise, perhaps. Okay, any more questions about analysing arguments? No? Good. Okay, we're now going to look at distinguishing the different types of arguments. Okay, there are two... I hope you can see that, actually. That doesn't come out quite as well as I thought it would. Two overarching types of arguments, deduction and induction. And within those categories, there are lots of other types of arguments. So within the category of inductive arguments, there are arguments from analogy, arguments from authority, inductive generalizations, causal generalizations. And within the category of deductive argument, you've got modus tollens, modus ponens, etc., etc., etc. So each category has many subcategories, but these are the two overarching categories. Sometimes people add a third category to that. They talk about abductive arguments, which are arguments to the best explanation. I include those in inductive arguments, so I'm not forgetting them if anyone has thought of arguments to the best explanation. I'm treating them as inductive.
Are they in here?
All the handouts have... There are, you haven't got that handout.
No.
But when you get it,
I will get it.
You will, yes, you won't have to write it down. Okay, so these are the differences. Deductive arguments are either good or bad. Okay, they're either good or bad, there's nothing in between. If it's not bad, it's good. If it's not good, it's bad. That's not true of inductive arguments. They're always good or bad to some degree. They're more or less good. Deductive arguments are conclusive. They give us absolute certainty, usually a conditional certainty, but they give us certainty. Inductive arguments never give us certainty. They only ever give us probability, maybe a very strong probability, but it's never as high as certainty. Deductive arguments are evaluable a priori. Can anyone tell me what that means? I know some of you.
Before you? From the beginning.
From the meaning of the terms.
Yes, from the meaning of the terms. You can do it without experience. You don't need to know anything about the subject matter of the argument in order to evaluate a deductive argument. Whereas inductive arguments are evaluable only a posteriori. In other words, you have to understand something about your subject matter in order to evaluate an inductive argument. Okay, those are three distinctions between inductive and deductive arguments. Let's have a closer look at them. Okay, so the first difference, deductive arguments are either good or they're bad. Inductive arguments are only ever good or bad to some degree. So, deductive arguments are either good or they're bad. If a deductive argument is good, it's called valid. If a deductive argument is bad, it's called invalid. And in your handouts, there's a... Have you got the handouts?
Yeah.
It's the question thing I didn't give out. Okay, have a look at your handout, because I think I want to tell you something about this. On page 2-5. It's very, very important that a good deductive argument need not have true premises. So if you look at the handout, look at slide 41. See where I am on page 2?
This doesn't seem...
You've got the wrong handout, Verna.
Yeah.
Fault. This is the one. That's right, there's too many handouts. I don't quite understand why you're...
Thank you.
Has everyone got the right page? Yep. Yes, good. Okay. So slide 41, validity. The definition of validity tells us Okay, so here's the definition of validity. A deductive argument is valid if and only if there's no logically possible situation in which its premises are true and its conclusion false. So listen to that. If and only if, in other words, this is a both a necessary and a sufficient condition for an argument's being valid, there is no logically possible situation in which its premises are true and its conclusion false. If there is a situation where its premises could be true and its conclusion false, the argument is invalid. Otherwise, it's valid. And important implication of that, if you look, people have trouble wrapping their minds around the first two of the following three facts. Okay, so arguments with false premises and a false conclusion can be valid. And I've given an example of that at the bottom of the page. All fish have wings. Whales are fish. Whales have wings. Okay, if those premises were both true, the conclusion would have to be true, wouldn't it? If those premises were both true, are you with me?
Yes.
The conclusion would have to be true. Do you see yes. that? That's what makes that argument valid. The fact that the premises are both false, and indeed the conclusion's false, doesn't stop the argument being valid. We know that if the premises were true, the conclusion would be true, and that's all we need. Have a look at the invalid one. I mean, here we have another argument where the premises are both false and the conclusion is false. All fish have scales. Whales have scales. Whales are fish. Do you see that that's not a good argument? There is a situation where both those premises are true and the conclusion is false, isn't there? So if we draw a Venn diagram, I can find a decent pen. All fish have scales, so this is fish, and this is things with scales. Whales are fish, whales have scales, therefore whales are fish. Well, no, not if whales are here. Fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a possible situation in which both those premises are true, but the conclusion is false, and that argument is invalid. So you can't tell anything about the validity or the invalidity of the argument on the basis of the fact that all its premises are false and its conclusion false. It could be valid, it could be invalid, you don't know. Validity is not determined by the truth or falsehood of the premises. Look at the second situation, where the premises are all false and the conclusion is true. Now that too is a situation where the argument might be valid or it might be invalid. And I've given an example of each of those. So can you see that if it was true that all fish have lungs and that whales are fish, whales would have to have lungs, wouldn't they? If it were true that all fish have lungs and that whales are fish, whales would have to have lungs. Okay, so that's a valid argument. But on the other side, we've got an invalid one. All fish have scales. So this is the other way around. We've got the category of fish and the category of scales here. And it says whales are not fish. Where should I put the whales? It's not to begin to think.
Scales.
You know, over left the edge, should be fish.
All fish.
Do you think one person can tell me? It's getting very confusing.
It's scales. I think so.
It's the same as in the top diagram.
Oh, right.
Scales is the big circle, fish is the small circle.
Yes, that's right. Whales, not fish. Okay.
But you've drawn it the other way around at the bottom.
Which I shouldn't have done. Yes. Okay. The important point to get from this is just as we cannot tell from the fact that all the premises and the conclusion is false, whether the argument is valid or invalid, we cannot tell from the fact that the premises are all false and the conclusion is true that the argument is valid or invalid. Validity is not determined by the truth or falsehood of the premises, or rather it is, But the only thing that's ruled out by the validity of the argument is a situation where the premises are true and the conclusion false.
It boils into set scales, as the null set, there are no elements in that set that doesn't exist. Finished.
Irrelevant. Irrelevant. Because if it were true...
Yes, scales into set scales.
Wells what?
Wells into set scales. There's nothing in that set, so it's a null set, and so there's no members of that set, so it doesn't exist, and so everything falls down.
Okay, terrible. Even so, everything I'm saying is true. So I've got to say to it's difficult for me to think. So I put the handout is there, so you can go back and check that for yourselves later on. We're not evaluating arguments at the moment, so again, I don't want to... But I do want to point out that validity, a deductive argument is valid if and only if there's no logically possible situation in which its premises are true and its conclusion false. Any other situation, the argument might be invalid. And you can see that either an argument's got to be valid or it's got to be invalid. I mean, either there is a situation in which the premises are all true and the conclusion false, in which case the argument's invalid, or there isn't such a situation, in which case the argument's valid. So it's got to be either valid or invalid. There's no in-between for a deductive argument. And importantly, logical possibility differs from empirical possibility. And again, we'll see some more about this later on. It may be impossible for I think I might be anticipating an argument I'm going to give later, so I won't continue with that form. But in your handouts, there's an explanation of the difference between logical and empirical possibility as well.
Isn't it possible that you could have something that isn't clearly true or false?
Well, there's a difference between our ability to know that something's true or false and something's being true or false. So that's the difference between epistemology and metaphysics. So the question of whether we know it's true or false is an epistemological question. The question of whether it is true or false is a metaphysical question. This is a metaphysical definition. It's not interested in your knowledge. I mean, often we don't know whether a premise is true or false. Yeah. So our knowledge from the deductive validity of the argument is conditional. We know that if this premise is true, and if this premise is true, then this conclusion must be true. Mm-hmm. And now we've got to go and conduct an experiment or take out our telescope or whatever and find out whether the premises are true.
What if we didn't know that it was true?
Well, that's what I'm suggesting, that let's take this
is that
as
non-inductive reasoning to deductive?
No, I'm only talking about deduction at the moment. There is a planet in between the Sun and Mars. That planet is called Vulcan.
Oh, I think you mean Mercury then.
It's Mercury. Okay, when people made this argument, I don't think this is a very good argument, incidentally, but never mind, but I hope it'll make my point. When people, they believed that this was true, or that it was possibly true, they didn't know it for sure. It was only later on that we found out that this wasn't true. And if you have this is less interesting than an argument I could have put together, but you can imagine that if this is true and this is true, then this must be true.
But all I'm saying is, what if one of these you didn't know whether it was true or false?
But that's what I'm saying is irrelevant. Because if that's true, if that is true, and if that is true, then that must be true. That's got nothing to do with whether we know any of these things are true.
You always assume true. You're always assuming that those are true to then...
No, nobody is assuming, listen to me, if that's true, this is a conditional. Okay, if that is true, and that is true, then that must be true. I mean, if you're a scientist, you're thinking, well, okay, I've got my hypothesis here, all swans are white, forgive the hackneyed example, but it's 4:10. If all swans are white, and if that animal is a swan, then that animal must be white.
But what if you weren't sure that all swans are white?
Can somebody explain this?
I think the problem is, you can answer that question without knowing anything about astronomy. That's a statement of logic. Forget astronomy, we don't have telescopes or anything.
It's
a valid argument.
Swan experts, we use logic to set up our experiment. If we get our logic wrong, then we're going to be looking for the wrong things. But we don't need to know the truth of our premises before. What we're trying to do is find out the truth of our premises in order to find out the truth of our conclusion.
Validity isn't related to the true or false thing.
No, that's not the point.
But you're saying it was.
No, because first
this is the definition of validity, so it is related to truth or falsehood. But look at the definition. An argument is valid if and only if there is no logically possible situation in which the premises are true and the conclusion false. That can be determined without knowing whether the premises actually are true or are false.
I think the problem I had last year on
that we probably ought to stop this, because I think everybody, I mean, who understands this point? Okay, Kirsty, would you mind if Bill or somebody or I, were to take your side, and because I think that this is something that I need to continue.
Maybe if you deal with that point at the bottom, the asterisk.
That's what it's all about.
Okay. The handout deals with that, and it isn't strictly relevant to what we're doing. Actually, I'd rather not deal with that now. I hope that there'll be some time for questions, in which case I will deal with it. Okay. But the important point here is that deductive arguments are either good or they're bad. They're either valid or invalid, and what makes an argument valid is that there's no logically possible situation in which its premises are true and its conclusion false. And to know whether that's the case or not, it's not necessary to know the actual truth value. All that's necessary is to know the relations between the truth values of the statements.
Could you give Kirsten an example in which one of your premises dragons are green?
Everyone understands, except for, sorry, Kirsten. Okay, so what have I got here? Okay, this is a valid argument, I think, or as I was going to ask you this. Premise one, if the patient has Huntington's disease, the patient will have the HD gene on chromosome 4. Premise two, the patient has HD, Huntington's disease. Conclusion, the patient will have the HD gene on chromosome 4. Second argument, if the patient has Huntington's disease, the patient will have the HD gene on chromosome 4. Premise two, the patient has the HD gene on chromosome 4. Conclusion, the patient will have HD. One of those is valid. The other is invalid. Which is which?
Invalid.
That's invalid. Why is that the case?
Because...
You're very quick.
But I can't explain it. Because the conclusion is wrong. The conclusion should be that the Huntington's disease exists on the HD. It doesn't automatically, we can't assume the patient has HD, is my conclusion I want to get to.
Yes, okay. So what we're doing here is we're affirming the consequence of this. So we're saying if the patient has Huntington's disease, the patient will have the HD gene on chromosome 4. The patient has the HD gene on chromosome 4, therefore the patient has HD. Well, no, because what we're saying is it's necessary for having Huntington's disease that you have the HD gene on chromosome 4. It's not sufficient for having Huntington's disease
that you have the HD gene on chromosome 4. And I'd just like to point out the difference between logical and empirical possibility. We actually know, some of us, that if you have the HD gene on chromosome 4, you will have Huntington's disease. In other words, that's empirically possible. Empirically, that's a good claim, because in fact, having the HD gene on chromosome 4 is both necessary and sufficient for having Huntington's disease. Is that right? We've got one medic in the room, I think.
Heaven's alive, I'm not a medic.
He's not a medic. Okay. But, okay, you take it from me, it is necessary and sufficient. But this doesn't say it's necessary and sufficient, does it? Well, which is what we've done here.
No, if you turn that round.
If the patient, if you had if the HD on chromosome 4, you would have Huntington's disease.
Then it would be valid, yep, that would be right. Or if you did it this way round, it would be valid. What's not valid about this is that we've said it's a necessary condition, and what we've done is we've assumed it's a sufficient condition too. This argument is not valid. And we can determine that without knowing anything at all about Huntington's disease. I'll convince you of that later on. Okay, so that's valid because there's no... If that's true and that's true, that must be true.
Yeah.
That's invalid because there's a possible situation in which that's true... There's a logically possible situation in which that's true and that's true, but that's not true. Okay? The fact there's no empirically possible situation in which that's true and that's true and that's not true is irrelevant. Okay? That's why logical possibility is important. Okay, so inductive arguments are either strong or weak. And the extent to which an inductive argument is strong or weak depends on the extent to which the truth of its premises make the truth of its conclusion more likely. And the strength or weakness of an inductive argument is a matter of degree. So here are two inductive arguments. Every day in the history of the world, the sun has risen. Therefore, the sun will rise tomorrow. I think you can see that's a pretty strong inductive argument. We do expect the sun will rise tomorrow. Argument two, every time I've seen Marianne, she's been wearing earrings. That may be true for you. Next time I see Marianne, she'll be wearing earrings. Well, maybe not. Maybe it might be my day off from wearing earrings or whatever. Or you've come round particularly early in the morning or something like that. But we can see that underlying both these arguments is something called the principle of the uniformity of nature. This is an assumption that we all make. We cannot not make it. We operate with this all the time. It might not rise tomorrow. Tonight might be the night that a meteorite hits the sun and it explodes. So even though every time, every day in the history of the world we've seen the sun rise, we can't be certain it's going to rise tomorrow. So whereas with a deductive argument, if the premises are true, we can be absolutely certain the conclusion will be true. With an inductive argument, the premises could be true and very strong, and yet there's still a question mark over the conclusion. But that's strong and that's weak. So, again, an exercise to do at home, and I really will let you do that at home, because I can't think straight anymore. Okay, so deductive arguments are either valid, good, or invalid, bad. But inductive arguments are only ever good or bad to some degree. They're inductively strong or inductively weak. Okay, so that's the first difference. Any quick questions about the first difference? No? Good. Okay. So, the second difference is deductively valid arguments are conclusively valid. Nothing we could learn could ever change their validity. Okay, so not only are they certain, they're conclusively certain. Inductive arguments give us only probability, and it's always possible to learn something that would change the degree of possible probability, that would enable us to think that actually that was a weak argument, but now I know that, it's become a strong argument. So invalid arguments give us no knowledge at all. If we go back to that, that one, you see we get no knowledge at all from this statement here. it doesn't follow from, or at least not from the argument itself, it doesn't follow from the premises. So is it true or false? Well, how do we know? We have no reason to think it's either. So we can sometimes, by adding further premises, make an invalid argument valid. So I'm going to give you a new word here. A property is monotonic if and only if, and that's not a spelling mistake, that means if and only if. A property is monotonic if it cannot be changed by the addition of new information, and a property is non-monotonic if and only if it can be changed by the addition of new information. So deductive validity is monotonic. If an argument is deductively valid, nothing we could learn will change its validity. There's no premise we could add that will make a valid argument invalid. Invalidity is non-monotonic. We can add premises to an invalid argument and make it valid. And inductive strength is non-monotonic. It's always possible to learn something that will change the strength of an inductive argument. So, consider this valid argument. If it's spring, the snowdrops will be out. If it is spring, the snowdrops will be out. Can you see that if that's true and that's true, that must be true? Yeah, everyone accept that? Can we add anything to that to change the fact that it's a valid argument to its being an invalid argument? Would anyone like to try? It won't let me write on the screen, I'm afraid.
In Australia.
Where do you want to write in Australia?
It is spring in Australia, the snowdrops are out there.
Hang on. Okay, you want to add in Australia to that one?
Yes, please.
Well, you've got to add a new premise, haven't you?
But then you'd have to add it here as well. Yes, it's a premise, not an addition to one of the premises that we want to add.
You can't change a premise, say.
We can't add a premise here that would change this argument into an invalid argument.
You're asking in the exercise not to change a premise, but to add a premise. Can you have add a premise here that the snowdrops are not out?
Yep, let's try that. Okay, so that originally was a valid argument. So if those two were true, that had to be true. Okay, has it changed to an invalid argument? Is it the case that there is a possible situation where all of those are true and that's not true? Is there
a contradiction?
It's a contradiction.
Oh, yeah, it's
a contradiction. Sure, it will be a contradiction.
If that's true, and that's true, and that's true.
Well, there might be some other reason why the snowdrops.
That can't be true.
No.
If that's true, and that's true, and that's true.
Yes.
Then that
because the snowdrops might not have come out for some other reason other than...
They might come out in spring. Spring is over a period of time, isn't it? And if you say
real here... Listen, I can do this for you. Let me do it formally, because I think I can convince you formally much more quickly. And I can do it formally, and I can't do it informally at the moment. Here is a truth table. We're going to be meeting truth tables later on. Do you accept the argument if P then Q, P therefore
Q?
Q. Yes. Do you accept that that's a valid argument? Okay, well here's a truth table. If P then Q, P therefore Q. Okay, now this is I don't mind doing this because you're going to be learning this later on, so it's giving you a little, this is a tabular representation of all the truth conditions to do with this argument. This is the world in which P is true and Q is true, okay? This is the world in which P is true and Q is false, okay? This is the world in which P is false and Q is true. and this is the world in which P and Q are both false. Are you with me where I'm going on this? Okay, so let's just fill in. So we know that Q is true, false, true, false. I've put them lowercase just to distinguish them. P is true, true, false, false. If P then Q, now you're going to have to take this on authority for the moment. That's true, false, true, true.
True.
I'm sorry, you will have to take that on authority for the moment. Is there a possible situation in which the premises are true and the conclusion false? True, true, but that's true, so that's all right. That's not the case, the situation where the premises are both true. That's not a situation where the premises are both true, and neither is that. So there is no logically possible situation where the premises are all true and the conclusion false on that one. Okay, it's a valid argument. Now, let's add in this other, what was it?
Snowdrops are not round.
So it's not Q, in effect, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's add it in. Should have left myself some room. Let's add not Q there. Okay, so Q is true, false. So here we've got false, true, false, true. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now, have we got a situation where the premises are all true and the conclusion is false? True, true, no. So that turns into a...
Yes.
Doesn't it? False, true, true. True, false, false. True, false, true.
Yes.
So we still haven't got a situation where all the premises are true and the conclusion's false. And how's that? You've done truth tables in the very first session. I'm really impressed. Do you understand that? I mean, can you see what I'm saying? You may need to think about it to understand it, but importantly, it doesn't matter what you add here, you will never change the validity of that argument. It's just impossible. Because if you add a false premise, as we did here, you just change it from being a tick to being a dash. And if you add a true premise, you just add another true premise. So then you'd have true, 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 true.
It's what's the heading between P and Q? What's the heading at the top? No.
That's just the original argument, which is...
No, in that line you've got there, is what's that? This is before Q.
Therefore,
okay.
That's the argument, okay, which is what I'm either taking or would give across if there wasn't an argument. Oh, good. Well, that saved me some time. Okay, so if we add a true premise to a valid argument, it's not going to change the relation of premises and conclusion. All we do is add another true premise, and if we add a false premise, as we did there, we haven't changed the relation between premise and conclusion that makes it valid. So, validity gives us certainty. If the premises are true and the argument is valid, notice if the premises are true and the argument's valid, then the conclusion is also true and nothing will ever change this. It's both certain and conclusive. Invalid arguments can be made valid by the addition of extra premises. And I said thanks to Bill here for this example. This is Bill. So premise one, all normal cats are four-legged, all mammals give birth to live young, all normal cats give birth to live young. This is invalid because there's a logically, though not an empirically possible situation in which the premises of this argument are true but the conclusion is false. Can you tell me what that situation is?
Well, the cat's been done.
I don't think that's the one I've got.
All normal cats.
Cats are not mammals?
Cats are not mammals.
Yeah, I think there are some things, aren't there, like vipers, lizards, that aren't mammals that do give birth to live young.
You're overthinking. I think you're all tired now, I'm going to tell you. Okay, but if we add all four-legged animals and mammals, we'll get a valid argument there, won't we?
Oh, right.
All normal cats are four-legged. All mammals give birth to live young. All normal cats give birth to live young is not valid, is it?
because it's...
But if we add all normal cats, sorry, all mammals and four-legged or...
No, all cats.
All four-legged animals and mammals, then we get a valid argument. So invalidity is non-monotonic, even though validity is monotonic. Inductive arguments can always be weakened. Every day in the history of the world, the sun has risen, the sun will rise tomorrow, but what if we learn there's a gigantic meteor about to hit the sun? Okay, that would change our belief that that's a strong inductive argument, wouldn't it? And so here's one. Jones was present at the crime scene. Jones is guilty of the crime. That's a weak argument. I mean, maybe the other people were present at the crime scene. But if we add, Smith, the policeman who tried to stop Jones kill the man, saw Jones plunge the dagger into the man's heart, that strengthens the argument that something's rotten, doesn't it? So you see that... We can, what?
Not if you've got a faint.
But you see that we can take an inductive argument, doesn't matter how strong, and weaken it. And we can take a weak inductive argument and we can strengthen it by the addition of more information. So deductively valid arguments are conclusively valid and give us certainty. Inductive arguments are never conclusively good or bad. They always rest on this principle of the uniformity of nature. They only ever give us more or less probability, and that might change as we learn more about the probabilities there are in the world. And invalid arguments give us no knowledge at all, but they can sometimes be made valid by the addition of further premises. So valid arguments are monotonic, deductive validity is monotonic, it will never change. Induction and invalidity are non-monotonic. Nice word for you. Oh God, haven't we done difference three yet? Never mind, that's an interesting one. We need absolutely no background information about the world. You need to know anything about the subject matter of a deductive argument in order to evaluate it. Now, isn't that interesting? I can see lots of people frowning here. But we always need background information to evaluate an inductive argument. It can only ever be evaluated a posteriori. Okay, now, you didn't use background knowledge to find out the missing premise in the invalid argument we used before, the one about the cat. You would have been able to find that premise even if you knew nothing about cats, mammals, four-legged animals, or live births. But maybe you don't agree with that, maybe you don't accept that. Okay, is this argument valid? And if not, is there something we can add to it that would make it valid? Put up your hands if you think it's invalid.
The definition is
Do you need to know what it means? Is it a valid or an invalid argument, this one? Put your hand up if you think it's invalid.
This one?
Yeah, this one. And think about a premise you can add to it that would make it valid. Okay, who's got the extra premise? Okay. Martin.
All belly bluffs are
bedal. All belly bluffs are bedal. Or if it's a belly bluff, it is bedal. Yeah. Bedal. Do you see you were able to do that? I mean, you have no idea what we're talking about here. That's because we're not talking about anything. And these are made up words. I made them up. But you see, you can do it. And the reason you can do it is because you don't actually, it's the logical words that matter. It's the if and the therefore, the fact it's a if then and so on. Okay, there's only if then, it's the only logical words that appears in that argument. But you could do it with any logical combination of logical words like if then and or if and only if, etc. You can always do that with a deductive argument. Surprising, isn't it? What about that one? Is that a good argument or not? Put your hand up if you think it's a good argument. If a widgel is a pterygore, then it is grew. This widgel is a pterygore, this visual is grew, therefore this visual is grew. It's valid, isn't it? And again, you have no idea what it's about because it's not about anything. I made it all up. But it does matter because you've got the if then and you've got the is that you understand and the relation between premises and conclusion that you understand. Okay, so deductive logic, I mean, what this tells us is that deductive logic is the ultimate transferable skill. My brother is a geologist, and he once rang me up and said that he and one of his pals were having an argument about a paper. Would I have a look at it? Now, I know absolutely nothing about salt deposits or whatever that they were talking about, but that's all right, because I was able to see that the argument that they were using was actually invalid, and that in order to be made valid, it needed this. Whether that was true or not, I have no idea. But I didn't even know what it meant. But it didn't matter. Because he knew what it meant, and he was able to go and add that premise. So I can't remember what he did. So deductive logic is topic neutral. It can be applied to any subject matter, even if you know nothing about that subject matter. And that's because only the logical form of a deductive argument is what counts when it comes to determining its validity, not the actual truth conditions of the premises and conclusions. So we can always evaluate deductive arguments a priori. Here is the logical form, just to give you an idea of what I mean. All the previous slides, I've used various arguments, and here I'm just giving you the logical form. I'm taking out the contents completely. So we've got one argument that was if P, then Q, if R, then S, if conclusion, if P, then S. And you can see that's valid, probably.
P, then Q, R, then S, then okay.
That's valid. If P, then Q. Sorry,
no,
it's not valid, is it?
No.
What should I have?
Q,
then S. Good. Well, there you are. You've shown me that you understand it just from doing that. Have a look at those. Those are just for you to look at. They are supposed to be a representation in logical form of the arguments in the other slides. Inductive arguments are such that we always need to bring to bear our background knowledge of the world to evaluate them. So if we look at this, for example, every time I've seen Marianne, she's been wearing earrings. Next time I see Marianne, she'll be wearing earrings. Okay, what do you need to evaluate that, whether it's a good argument or not?
How many times have you seen?
How many, exactly. If you've seen me only once, that's a much weaker argument than if you've seen me hundreds of times. Good. Anything else?
Something about your personality.
Yeah, or you could say if you come round and knock on my door at 2 o'clock in the morning, you probably won't see me wearing earrings.
Yes, you are.
So that the times when I had been wearing earrings might have all been during the hours of.
But if you were, it would be even more sure.
Well, that would be another incident. Certainly true. Yes. Okay, I'm going to move on because all I want to point out there, and you can have a look at these at home and see for yourself that you'll need to know something about Marianne, something about earrings, something about Huntington's disease, something about the sun, in order to evaluate all these. You can't do it a priori as you can with a... These are the three things that we've got to ask to determine the difference between a deductive and inductive argument. I'm not going to go through them because we've gone through them. That's just a summary of all the things we've been saying. And here's an exercise to do at home, which is determine whether they're inductive or deductive arguments, and the answers are in your answers sheet. And so we've learnt how to recognise arguments, how to analyse arguments, how to distinguish deductive arguments from inductive arguments, and I realise that that's a real canter through, and there are all sorts of things like logical and empirical possibility and the nature of validity that you're probably very hazy about, but you've got the handouts that will help you with that, and the podcasts on critical reasoning, if you've not seen them, there's a session devoted to each of those things, so much more devoted to each of those things than we've been able to give it here. What we're going to do, well, I don't need to tell you that. Oh, there's a quiz for you too. How about that? And there's an advertisement as well. And now we're going to have coffee.